Thank you for joining us today at Mormon Stories. A few quick reminders. If you value what we're doing here at Mormon Stories and want to keep this program alive past July 2010, please consider signing up today to become a monthly paid subscriber to Mormon Stories. All donations are tax deductible. They will go directly to the time and materials used to produce the show. And you can sign up for as little as $5 a month at mormonstories.org. Thank you for listening, and please enjoy the show.
So we've provided two or three examples here about some of the sort of funny dynamics when you inject a corporate model into the operation of a spiritual church. Why don't we turn now to the issue of money and just sort of the question of whether the money that the church has ultimately gets spent in ways that reflect our highest spiritual values, which is an issue you raise in the book. You explain in your book how at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, the tithing requirement was monetized, meaning that tithing needed to be paid in the form of money rather than labor or livestock or, you know, eggs, some other donation of value. And you discuss how this monetization of tithing was a major change that had a tremendous impact on shaping the modern church. Why don't you tell us about that?
So the you know, as you mentioned, you know, again with Snower, sort of understanding of that is that he got the church out of debt by instituting a new kind of tithe, and of course promised that the windows of heaven would open. That's probably the phrase that most Mormons would understand, sort of a historical vignette. But there's much more going on than just opening up the windows of heaven here. When you monetize tithing and you make it 10% of your income, you change the dynamics dramatically. So the sort of easy way to think of this is that you can't really put a bunch of chicken eggs into a truck, ship them all down to Salt Lake City, and put them into a bank and accrue interest on the chicken eggs, and then move those chicken eggs out to Guatemala. You can do that when you're just dealing with capital. So what you have here is a kind of, at the turn of the century, a move from a sort of spiritual economy of tithing and fast offerings, which was very minimal in terms of what they could actually bring in, but that was also clearly tied to our physical bodies and to the sort of the natural cycles of the earth. So if you could pay tithing in milk, you couldn't hold on to that milk forever. You had to do something with it, and that something had to be more or less given it to people who needed milk. Same thing with, you know, chicken eggs or wheat. You distributed these things as a bishop to people who needed wheat and chicken eggs.
So tithing really gets spent, I mean, largely in the form of assistance to the needy.
That's right. It goes right back out to the people in the local community. Whereas by the time you monetize it, and the main real impulse to monetize it was that Lorenzo Snow tried to pass bonds to Eastern bankers in order to get the church out of its debt that it had created with the Salt Lake Temple, literally sell the church into bondage. This strategy wasn't terribly successful, but what they could get done was that they could get the members to sort of pour in liquid capital, and that's exactly what they did. Is they changed what tithing was and said, well, it's got to be money. This is what we need in order to pay off our debts. And the windows of heaven indeed opened, and massive amounts of capital poured in so that the church was out of debt very quickly. But then the question is, now we've got a kind of problem of having too much money. What are we going to do with all this money? And you know, back then they started, you know, sugar companies and railroad companies and electric companies, sort of social services, you might say, with the money to modernize the West and to really increase the quality of life among everybody out here, Mormons or non-Mormons. Now, in the 1960s, they had a real struggle, and eventually one side won, which was then they decided that they could indeed invest tithing money. And once you begin to invest tithing money, you create an entirely different dynamic with respect to what decisions are going to be made at the church headquarters. And one of the sort of easiest way to illustrate this is with the Perpetual Education Fund, which is, you know, a sort of benevolent fund that most people would agree with and probably donate to, which is to provide educational loans to people in other countries so that they can attend usually technical training and support the families. You know, a great idea. It wasn't an idea original to the church office building. But nevertheless, they sort of managed the funds for this, and the money poured in again. But the way that it works is that the money that is actually loaned out is the interest that accrues on the fund. And so none of the money actually that is donated is ever put at risk. The interest is donated out, and it's donated at a certain with an interest rate that the debtor has to begin to repay to the church as soon as they take out the loan. So the fund will always go up as long as the investments that the fund is tied to are going up. And, you know, I imagine that they made very wise financial decisions and invested in sort of long-term bonds or something. I don't really know what kind of investments are good or bad. But what this does is it changes the dynamic in terms of what the church is up to. And rather than sort of continually fund things like a sugar operation so that we can get sugar here, and even though we have to sort of continually subsidize the sugar operation, which is what happened in the early 1900s and prior to that, what you have going on now is decisions being made that how can we sort of get the expenses down that are tied to the corporation and always keep the revenue up, which is to say, we're not going to invest in operations that are losing money. We're not going to fund a hospital that is going to be a continual loser in terms of its money. Now, you know, of course, they fund things like welfare farms and other operations that are designed to be charitable works, but you can see the transition just if you go into Deseret Industries, where of course they receive all their merchandise as a donation, but you know, as a part of this sort of transition in the 1980s and 1990s towards a more sort of finance sensitive corporation, Deseret Industries is a real moneymaker, as I understand it. And of course, it's justified because the profits that accrue from Deseret Industries are to be put towards funding other good works. But what you have here is actually a division between the sort of charitable side of things, which is, if you actually look at the amount of capital that is donated to humanitarian aid with respect to the amount of money that is brought in through the donation streams of fast offerings and tithings, you see that it's really surprisingly small amount of money goes towards humanitarian aid, and that increasingly the day-to-day operations of the corporation are being funded by volunteers, which makes sense, of course, if you have a corporation. You know, why put all your money into payroll when you could just have missionaries, quote-unquote, doing data entry? So again, in the 1980s, they began to move towards a sort of volunteer-based model of running the operations of the corporate side of things. And of course, this is drawing on the sort of church side to make it so that the corporate side doesn't have the expenses that it used to have. Now, the problem is, of course, they're not doing this because they don't have any money. They're doing it because it makes sense financially to free up more and more capital. And so the question then is, what is going on with all this money if the expenses of the day-to-day operations are continually being driven down? Then what is really going to be going on with the rest of the money? And it is being invested, for the most part, in real estate throughout the 1990s and then in the previous decade, which was part of the building spree of the corporation of the presiding bishop, but also in Wells Fargo mortgage-backed securities and Citibank, and in many other major funds, which you know I sort of document in the book, which I can't really reel off right now. But you know, you're talking a real lot of money that is being invested in things which, again, it makes sense if you're a business to do this kind of thing, of course, and it makes sense maybe if you're an individual to invest in these, you know, in these funds that are going to be bringing back a lot of money. But the question that I really want to sort of put forward in the book is, does it make sense for a religion to be doing this kind of stuff? And of course, a lot of the listeners will say, yeah, of course. And a lot of the listeners maybe will say, well, maybe it doesn't make a lot of sense. You know, in the book, I try to sort of put forward an argument as to why it doesn't necessarily make sense from a metaphysical perspective, from a cultural perspective, and even from an economic perspective. If you're just a strict businessman or a businesswoman, maybe it doesn't make a lot of sense actually to be setting up things in this manner either.
Well, it sounds like the approach that's or the philosophy that's been adopted is that we ought to be using our business acumen to invest tithing funds in a way that will cause them to multiply and replenish the balance sheets in order to ultimately do good.
Right.
And so what's the problem?
Yeah, well, this is, you know, a difficult dilemma. It's one of these Faustian bargains that, you know, again, we traded away certain aspects of our religion, which were said to be essential, so that we could get statehood. And the idea was that once we had statehood, we would reinstitute these essential principles for our exaltation.
And you're talking about jettisoning polygamy and law of consecration in order to get statehood.
That's right. And, of course, you know, as far as I know, these things haven't been reinstituted. Though I suppose there could be an underground in which there are a bunch of Latter-day Saint polygamists. I doubt it, but...
perish the thought.
Yeah, so, you know, again, it's a question of a sort of means to an end. Is it acceptable for the kingdom of God to do this dance with people who are not necessarily, who may not seem like they're directly opposed to us? Of course, they're not bringing in the cannons like they did in 1857 and rolling them into Salt Lake City and keeping them pointed at the city. But it's the kind of thing that, you know, we have, as Neil Young once said, a kindler, gentler machine gun hand. The exercises of power in the modern world are much gentler than they used to be. And so the way that that mammon works is to make it seem like it makes perfect sense to play along, and that we can do it to our advantage, that we can make a deal with, as it were, the devil. And I'm not saying that rich people are the devil or that Citibank is the devil, but that things which are not, that don't have an interest in building up the kingdom of God, I believe are, of course, building up another kind of kingdom. And so the question for me is, and this is what I try to pose in the book without necessarily sort of grandstanding too much, is whether we can actually make these kinds of deals, and in fact, whether we need to be making these kinds of deals. If Jesus tells us to consider the lilies of the field, maybe we ought to be considering the lilies of the field rather than investing our funds in sort of a lily gilding operation that is going to yield an 8% profit for the next 50 years. In other words, is it right for us to build a foundation of security that is tied to the global economy, or should we be trying to do something which was maybe a little more in line with how I read what Joseph Smith was trying to do, which is create an order of people who are independent as much as possible from the operations of the world, because the world is fallen. It's in a state of sin. And for us to try to profit from the sin is a very dangerous, in my perspective, proposition.
So the question being, does the wise man build his house upon the long-term bonds?
Yeah, I mean, if there's sort of a run on sand, I guess you could build your house on sand and hope that you can flip it, you know, to the next guy before the sand really falls out from under you. But if, you know, 2008 is any kind of indicator, they didn't move from the sand quite fast enough, and I think they lost, and I don't have any sort of hard figures on this, but they lost a pile of cash in the stock market, as, you know, apparently a lot of people did. So, you know, again, if we were to invest strictly in things like humans and provide for the needs of the poor in third world countries, in here in Utah, there's a great many poor people, rather than, say, building a multi-billion dollar high-end retail establishment in downtown Salt Lake City, is that a bad financial decision? Well, who can say one way or the other? Is that a good spiritual decision? I'd say yeah. Is it a good spiritual decision to build a multi-billion dollar mall? I sort of leave that up to the readers to sort of try to see where Jesus raised that kind of capital in order to build, a mall in downtown Jerusalem so that he could have a foundation for building up his church.
I seem to recall him saying something about his kingdom not being of this world.
And not having anywhere to lay his head. To seek first the kingdom of God and all things will be added unto it is a principle that that I think is enunciated in not just the New Testament. And it's something which is a very hard thing, of course, for Mormons to really abide by. You know, we're told that our responsibility as priesthood holders is to get a solid job where we can take care of our families. And of course, that's absolutely true. The other side of it is, of course, we need to be taking care of our spiritual resources first and foremost and rely upon God to do the rest for us. At least that's how I read it.
What about the argument, Damon, that, you know, we've been there and done that? I mean, We tried to implement the law of consecration. We tried to live on communes. We tried to, take what the prophets viewed as being the economy of heaven, and we tried to bring that down to the earth. And it didn't work out so great. And so I guess the question being, is the alternative that you're proposing is it workable? I mean, have we already discovered that it's not workable in this world of ours?
Exactly what I would sort of propose in terms of the practical dynamics, I'm not sure. But is it workable by the sort of standards of the world? No, I'm sure it'd be a sort of financial disaster. Would that in some ways work in the eyes of heaven? Well, you know, look at Kirtland. They had a real financial disaster in Kirtland in 1836, 1837. You know, they had a depression going on. But they also had everybody putting whatever excess they had into building this temple, which was completely unfunctional from a business side of things. But you also had a lot of people having pretty remarkable visions and reporting a fairly fantastic phenomenon, which, I don't see a lot of reports of these things going on nowadays. Whether there'll be these kinds of charismatic experiences when they open up the City Creek Center, I've got my doubts. It was a terrible financial decision, and it really did a lot of damage to the members of the church, what happened in Kirtland when they began printing money for the anti-banking society. It was run by Joseph Smith. But if you look at Joseph Smith's life, the guy couldn't run a store. But yet he had apparently a lot of friends up in heaven.
So your point really is, maybe trying to institute the heavenly order on earth here is not going to make us wealthy. Maybe it's not going to even make us financially secure. Maybe it's even going to bankrupt us and put us into debt, like the experience of the early the early days in the church with Joseph Smith and Brigham Young demonstrated to us. But maybe what you're saying is we need to get comfortable perhaps with another version of Christianity in which God and Christ don't really care all that much about how much money we have.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at how they apparently use gold, they pave the roads with it. So, you know, gold apparently is not any more important to them than asphalt is for us. They've got tons of it, but they don't really care about it, apparently. So, you know, the question for me is, with respect to how the church office building runs, what is our tithing dollars? What are our tithing dollars doing to the religious side of things? And what we're getting is to be sort of honest, as I can possibly be here, what we're getting is a religion which makes sense, in terms of a balance sheet, which doesn't offend people, which doesn't, ask them necessarily to give all of their money, to this bishop who's then going to decide, how they're going to sort of redistribute it. We've got a religion which, it asks a lot in terms of time, and I don't want to diminish the sort of volunteer aspect that a lot of members have. And we've got a religion that asks a lot in terms of lifestyle. You know, we don't have to, you know, we apparently can't drink coffee and wine. But what we don't get is a religion which seems to be drawing clear and distinct lines in the side of money that it seems to be drawing in terms of gay marriage, or in terms of immorality among the teenagers, or in terms of pornography. They don't seem to be willing to sort of say, well, we have a hard time being chaste, even though we've made covenants to be chaste, so let's loosen up the rules a little bit and live a little. Yet you hear this argument being made with respect to consecration. It's not something that we're capable of doing, so of course we're not in any sense apparently bound by the covenants we've made to live this law. I think that is a dangerous position for Latter-day Saints to be in. If you make a covenant that you're going to do something, you need to do everything in your power to live that covenant. Any more than you might say, well, you know, it's really hard to keep my pants zipped up, as it were. So I'm not really going to follow that rule anymore. I don't think that flies.
And so you that kind of brings us to the issue of the sort of financial reporting or lack thereof. Basically, it's difficult to estimate how much money the church takes in. I think you estimated in your book somewhere between 5 and 6 billion. And you mentioned that, as I said, it's not exactly clear how this 5 or 6 billion gets spent. But you mentioned that members of the church, particularly those in Utah, certainly depend on the purchasing habits of the corporations that run the church. And so why don't you give us some examples of what are some of those kind of big ticket item expenditures that LDS business owners in Utah benefit from?
Yeah, and this is something which, is, again, kind of a tricky thing to discuss without offending a lot of people. But nevertheless, let's sort of rush ahead. You've got, I'm saying $5-6 billion a year that they're bringing in. They're spending approximately $2 billion a year just in materials management. So you're talking like buying paper and couches and carpet and, and sort of real estate.
So a third goes to infrastructure.
Right. And, and of this, you know, you've got a lot of things, you know, let's say carpet, for example. You're talking millions of dollars spent on carpet every year. How do you make sure you're getting a value for your dollar? Well, you know, they sort of have problems keeping track of how much money is being wasted on carpet. You're talking a couple $1 million a year, maybe, that is being that doesn't really have an accounting for where it was spent with respect to carpet. And this is just carpet. So you're talking $30-40 million a year being spent on automobiles. Do they need to be buying all these automobiles? You know, that's not really my job to say. Do they need to be spending $40 million a year on automobiles? Well, that's something that I suppose the listeners need to decide for themselves. You know, you've got $30, $40 million being spent on airline tickets, in part to fly missionaries, of course, but also to fly employees of the church office building to conduct evaluations as well as a kind of surveillance of what's going on the ground. You know, you've got... you know, the manuals, the presidents of the church manuals, the print runs for these things, once you sort of trace out all the costs that are involved, you're looking at probably $10 million for each title. Now, the question is, that's a great thing, of course, to be getting these teachings of the presidents of the church out into the hands of members, but does it need to be done this way? And is there really no poor among us so that we don't need to be worrying about feeding people? We can provide them with this kind of spiritual food. Is that the way it's supposed to be going? Well, Joseph Smith said you've got to feed them first before you can teach them. And at the church office building, there is plenty of research to indicate that many members of the church, indeed probably a majority of the members of the church, are in real poverty. They don't have enough to eat every day. And a lot of them actually, when they fast once a month, they miss two meals. This means missing 2 days of food because they're only eating once a day anyway. So, you know, this is, it's difficult to see maybe in the more affluent areas why this would be a problem that we're buying Avalons, the sort of luxury edition Avalon. This is good for Larry H. Miller, the late Larry H. Miller, and I'm not saying that to disparage the man. I seem to do a lot of good charitable work. But it's good for car dealers to sell their cars to the corporation. And it, of course, makes for softer travel for the people who are in these cars rather than, you know, requiring them to ride buses or to hitchhike a ride or to walk or to ride a donkey, I suppose. But these things come at a cost, and the cost is you've got many members, fellow brothers and sisters in Christ, who go without food on a daily basis, who literally search the dumps for their food. This is something which is known in the church office building, and it's something which is known to be a problem. It's also something which, in the church office building, as I document in the book, they're not really equipped in any ways to manage it. In large part because there's a great deal of distrust about how money is going to be distributed in the Philippines or in Bolivia or in Guatemala. And it's much easier to trust in the accounting that goes on here at the church office building than it is to give everything when you're asked by some some convert branch president in Paraguay. You know, he says he needs his money to feed people. Are we to trust him or not? You know, this is, it's a difficult thing for us to really wrestle with. And I don't want to sort of, you know, create this sort of sense of guilt or to accuse people or to condemn any of the listeners or indeed anybody at the church office building. But it is nevertheless a hard reality that the majority of the members of the of this non-existent church are members who are terribly poor, and are our priorities in the right spot when we're building high-end retail malls with the sort of sense that maybe in 10 years' time we'll have a real we'll be making a lot of money on the mall that then we can buy people rice so that they can eat twice a day. You know, for me, it's a very personal thing because I was involved in the evaluation of material that was designed to train people on how to administer welfare, and I saw firsthand the way that reports about how people live that they really do get much of their daily sustenance out of the garbage. And yet I see this going on as we're sitting around the conference table, which was not a cheap conference table, and we're watching the focus groups being conducted in Ghana, on a massive plasma flat screen TV through a satellite link up, and they're talking about the fact that they can't pay their school fees for their kids. And as they're talking about this, we're all, you know, enjoying corporate-funded catering, which isn't extravagant, of course, but nevertheless, it's much more than those people who are on the other side of the satellite link-up have on a daily basis. So it's a real difficult thing, and you know, the church office building, they take it very seriously, the obligation for us to take care of people around the world. The difficulty is that things are structured there in a way to disincentivize these kinds of programs that would be moving the kinds of resources, the medical resources, the financial resources, and the educational resources out into these corners of the world where we know they need to be.
Why don't you tell us then about, because you're sparking my memory of a story you related about a video that was made to train bishops all over the world in how to distribute church welfare, and what the overall message of that video was. Can you tell the listeners about that?
Yeah, the video was produced by the welfare department, and it was based upon research that they had that the main problem for most bishops around the world is not pornography, apparently, but it's that people don't have any food to eat, and so they created a video to train bishops on how to distribute these funds locally and to really sort of solve this problem. The movie, and my job was, of course, to evaluate how well the movie achieved what it was supposed to be doing. The movie was supposed to teach bishops how to administer welfare in the Lord's way. The message of the movie, however, didn't quite carry over once we showed it to people in other parts of the country, in other parts of the world, rather. The message was to teach self-reliance, so that the bishops could then teach members how to get off church welfare, which seemed in some ways contradictory to the problem. The problem was, of course, not that the bishops didn't know how to teach self-reliance. The problem was, of course, that people, no matter how self-reliant they tried to be, they simply didn't have enough money. There's research that we had in, you know, members in Mexico work 3-4 jobs, and they still don't have enough money to feed their families. So the answer that the movie was providing wasn't really a question that was being asked by the bishops around the world. The question, you know, the problem wasn't that we've got all these people who are on the welfare dole, who are siphoning all the money, yet that was what the movie was created to solve. And so the movie was about self-reliance, and it had a parable about seagulls, and that if you feed the seagulls, then they stop having any kind of instinctual drive to feed themselves, and of course, then they all die. The message was clear that by handing out church welfare, you're actually, in some ways, killing them. So it was a sort of tough love message, I suppose, and we showed it around the world to focus groups, and it didn't quite come out that clearly. In Africa, for example, they thought that the church was now being involved in a micro-lending program, which they thought was a great idea. It didn't happen, of course, but it was a great idea for them because they said the real problem is capital. We don't have any capital here to start businesses. It's not that the members are lazy and looking for the church to do everything for them. It's that there simply isn't a kind of infrastructure there to accomplish what the standard of living that that we'd like them to have.
So they interpreted the parable of teaching a man how to fish as to give him a microloan so he can, you know, get that capital to start his business and become self-reliant.
Right. So he can buy a fishing pole, and then once he's able to get a fishing pole, then he can hire other members in the ward who are also on church welfare to do his fishing for him, and then everybody will be doing great. The example in the story was about blenders. In the movie, the bishop buys a blender for a woman, and she starts a salsa operation and employs other members in the ward who are on church welfare. So we showed this in Mexico, and they praised it, and said it's really great, it's inspiring, and so on. But the problem is not a matter of we don't understand the principle of self-reliance. The problem is, how do we fill out the forms? And this was a similar problem when we showed it in Asia. The problem is not the members are lazy. The problem is that we don't know how to fill out the forms, and so the bishops end up paying out of their own pockets for the burial of members. We don't have enough money to bury our dead, and so the members are joining up with the Catholic Church so that because the Catholics will bury us. So you have here many problems that the movie was not in any way going to solve, and they knew the movie wasn't going to solve this. We had clear research that showed this. But the incentive in the church office building is to go from conception to release, and so the movie went forward as it was planned. I don't know that it was ever created or you know, sent out around the world. But it didn't get at the real problems that they knew were going on. And the issue is that the relationships are structured in the church office building to make it very difficult to solve these kinds of problems. You know, we were sitting around the table and saying, yeah, we really could start up clinics in the Philippines so that the members don't spend all their money on medicine and then they don't have anything to eat. We could do that. We've got the manpower. We've got the capital. We could easily set these things up in the Philippines. We don't. It's not church policy to do it. We could easily set up schools in Africa. We don't, why? Because it doesn't make sense. It's not something which you can really get a lot of people to rally behind, even though they may see the spiritual and sort of human benefits behind it. You can't get it through committee after committee after committee and get all the departments on board in the way you can for something like a training video that is going to teach self-reliance, that is going to free up more capital. People can get behind that, and they can see that it serves the interests of heaven, of course. Yes, we ought to be self-reliant, I suppose. And it also serves the interests of mammon, let's say.
Now, in your book, you make pretty clear that you don't necessarily see any gross examples of financial self-enrichment on the part of the general authorities, although they do get a living allowance, I think, as it's termed. But you do identify a certain sort of stratification in the church organization, that there is this sort of upper middle and lower class, and that the upper class enjoys certain perks and privileges that the other classes do not enjoy, and which are in fact financed by church members. And can you identify some of those perks or privileges that the sort of upper class in the corporate organization or church organization, if you prefer, might enjoy?
Yeah, and you know, and these really are minor things, and it seems like I'm just really nitpicking here, you know, and I've sort of got some kind of grudge against you know people who drive nice cars. I don't, you know, but the question for me is, you know, for example, there was a demand put in by a church authority. That they receive 100% cotton rag paper to write upon for all their correspondence, and that lesser figures in the church hierarchy would receive 50% rag, and the local leadership would receive 25% cotton rag paper. It's a minor thing, of course, but the problem, or at least the question for me, is why does there need to be any distinction? And the same thing goes on with automobiles. So missionaries, of course, at least, used to drive sort of entry-level economy sedans. They've moved up a little bit, at least in certain areas, because the materials management sells them after a couple of years. And so they go for the cars that hold their value a little bit better. But you have a sort of, whereas even up until the 1980s, most of the general authorities and missionaries and, you know, people who had access to the church motor pool drove more or less the same automobile. was kind of a push to give the general authorities better cars. Now, this didn't come from the general authorities. They didn't request that they all drive luxury Avalons. But nevertheless, it was sort of put upon them that they drive luxury Avalons. And while other people who are driving church automobiles don't get to drive that kind of a car. So it was a sort of nice way of rewarding men who had given up, you know, much in their careers and much in terms of family time to serve the corporation or the church. But it's also one of those things that isn't in any sense, as I see it, necessary. And, you know, this isn't a sort of criticism or to begrudge people who drive Avalons. But it's one of those things that, if you look at other instances in the church, or other times in the church, if you go back to Jesus's time, you know, I don't know that sort of the apostles rode around in, you know, sort of extravagant chariots while, you know, the other missionaries weren't, you know, given quite as nice a ride. And, you know, and again, it's not like they requested these things or that they even asked for them, but they do allow that kind of class distinction to hold in terms of automobiles, in terms of paper, in terms of airline tickets, anywhere that it's possible for the market to discriminate between upper, middle, and lower class, that discrimination will in some sense find its way into the church office building so that you can reward people who are high up in the spiritual hierarchy with goods that are marketed to people who are high up in the economic hierarchy.
So, you know, like you said, these sort of perks and privileges, you know, getting to fly first class or business class or, you know, driving an Avalon versus an Escort or you mentioned in their complimentary tickets, I guess, to church performances. That how did that work exactly? If you were related to a general authority, you would get free tickets, whereas, you know, people of any other sort of, you know, middle lower class who were not related to general authorities would have to buy their own tickets. I mean, I guess the other thing you mentioned was in your book was these food and cafeteria subsidies.
Yeah.
That go for people. Talk about that just a bit.
Well, the cafeteria itself, which feeds, you know, the employees of a church office building, is subsidized heavily by members, and it's not as if you know, everybody there is sort of scrimping to get by, and so can't afford, you know, to pay you know, $5 for a sandwich, so they get to pay $1.50 for a sandwich. You know, most of the people there are making adequate wages. You know, I don't know what they are, but I know that there are that they have, you know, people who are paid to decide what the going wages are in the area and to get pretty close to matching it. So, you know, the sacrifice factor, as I say, isn't really that great. I made more when I was working there than I did in academia. So, the cafeterias are subsidized, you know, let's say $100,000 a year, which isn't a great deal of money when you really look at the overall picture. But could that $100,000 a year go towards the homeless shelter that's a couple blocks down the street? Well, probably. Would that have a detrimental effect on the employees? I don't know. You know, the general authorities, you know, again, they eat not in the cafeteria, but they have sort of, they eat at, you know, a sort of a higher level of food that comes from the Lion House restaurant that is in Brigham Young's former residence. And again, this is subsidized at almost the same amount as the entire cafeteria is subsidized, which feeds thousands of people a day. And, you know, the issue here is, again, not if we compare that to the kind of perks that an executive has at, you know, at Microsoft or Apple or IBM, of course, there is no comparison. You know, they're riding around in limousines. They're eating, you know, I imagine, you know, pretty expensive restaurants, not at the Lion House. But again, you know, my question, and one of the things that sort of drove me to write a book like this, is not to sort of shame these men, into eating poor food, or to make them ride in coach because I begrudge their legroom. It's to sort of ask the question whether these kinds of things would be what you would see in heaven. Would you find those who are higher up in the spiritual hierarchy flying first class from Kolob Airlines? Not to be sort of too irreverent, but or do you find them actually being the least among them? And again, is this a wise financial decision if you compare them to how things are run at IBM? Of course, you know, we're getting a great value for the expertise that we bring in. Is it a great way of spiritually running things? I'm not the spiritual authority here, but I think if we just look through our Bibles or our Book of Mormons or our Doctrine and Covenants or our church history, it's clear that Joseph Smith wasn't driving around, in the best wagon. Not that he wanted it, but that people made him the best wagon and sort of forced him to drive around in it so that they could see that he was higher than everybody else. It's one of those things that in Dostoevsky's The Brothers Karamazov, where he's got an interview with the Grand Inquisitor. The Grand Inquisitor is telling this Messiah figure to play it up with the masses, to perform miracles for them, to accept the high offices. And, you know, these are the temptations that Satan offered Jesus, right? Put yourself upon the temple and cast yourself down so that the angels can save you. Turn this stone into bread. And don't just do it for yourself, but make bread for everybody. Then they'll like you. Jesus seemed to refuse these things, and I wonder if he had good reasons for refusing the kinds of privileges that he could have enjoyed, but apparently turned down.
So let's shift gears just a little bit. I want to talk about the public relations, the PR aspect of the corporation and how it influences things, and. You know, we did sort of a deep dive into correlation in the previous segment, and I think this is an interesting example of correlation being driven home all the way down to the local level, and that is this example that you told about the I Am Jane production.
Yeah,
and telling about what the performers of the show had to do and what they had to cut out in order to obtain approval to present that I Am Jane production in the church-owned office building, or in not the church office building, but in a church-owned meeting house or stake center, something like that. Can you tell the listeners, just summarize, what was the I Am Jane production? Who was putting it on? Where did they want to put it on, and what did they have to do and cut out of it in order to get approval?
Right. So the initial production was submitted to the Cultural Arts Committee, so that they could what was called the Genesis Group, which is a group of African American Mormons. They're sort of officially recognized as a group, and they submitted the script and the request to use, I believe, the Bountiful Center, which is sort of a smaller venue. And so, you know, they were told they have all these hoops to jump through, and that takes, you know, a couple of years to really sort of meet up with this, because you submit the script and then your script gets correlated, and then you have to revise the script usually. So the things that they were told they had to revise were based in historical fact, and they had to do with the experience of this woman named Jane, who was an African American who joined the Mormons.
Is this Jane Manning?
I'm not sure of the last name, actually. The name escapes me, but you know, you may be right. So her experience was a difficult thing, and it wasn't just in terms of persecution. She had a kind of typical American experience as a Mormon. And, you know,
well, if this is Jane Manning, I mean, if I recall correctly, her family converts in Buffalo, New York. They take a stagecoach as far as they can, but then, you know, their money doesn't take them far. They end up walking all the way to Nauvoo, and then she and her family end up walking from Nauvoo to Salt Lake.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just to kind of give you an idea of the faith of this world.
Right, right. And, you know, and so in when the script was submitted, there was a number of things they had to cross out. They had to cross out certain characterizations of Brigham Young as sort of shooting from the hip when he's up on the pulpit. They had to cut out her pregnancy outside of wedlock. They had to cut out the use of the N-word. In the script, so they had to cut out a great deal of things, and you know, and this wasn't just the Genesis group that has to sort of submit to these kinds of correlations, but even Brigham Young University, their dancing group, wanted to put on a dance at the conference center, and they showed I guess they had a video of this that they showed to one of these committees, and the committee thought that it was too suggestive, and so then they offered to put some of the members of their committee to oversee the future operations of the dance department at Brigham Young University to make sure that it was in line with the dance norms, apparently, at the church office building. So
sorry, if I could go back to the I Am Jane, I think the edit that surprised me the most was that they had to remove the reference to Elijah Abel, who is an African-American member of the church. They had to remove the reference to him having received the priesthood, which I understand to be a historical fact.
Yeah. And again, there wasn't any explanation as to why these things had to be removed. They just had to be removed if they wanted to use the church venue. And, you know, there was other constraints put upon them. They couldn't advertise, for example. They couldn't do this to make money or really even as a fundraiser. And whether they could really charge money for the production, you know, was another thing, though they had to pay you know, something like $1,000 for the privilege of using this theater. So, you know, they're put in a really tight financial spot, and then they're put into an even tighter artistic spot. And this isn't just this, you know, this group, but it's something which occurs to anybody who wants to produce church art. They've got to compete with this massive amount of capital and, you know, spiritual authority. So, you know, the influence of the church office building with respect to the art community in Utah really is rather massive. And it doesn't show up in very simple ways. And I go into in the book sort of tracing out the ways that art is converted into religion, meaning it is turned into and sort of, if it isn't overtly propaganda, if it is an overt propaganda that is serving a certain message in the church office building, this isn't my way of describing it. This is sort of how they would decide what is acceptable art. Then it doesn't get branded as being official Mormon art. And so what you have here is a kind of creation of a genre of Mormon art, which is then, you know, redistributed through church outlets like Deseret Book, Siegel Book, and you know, church magazines, and of course official productions at the conference center, and you know, this has real effects in terms of what Mormons can do through art, and you know, whether they can talk about this African American former slave, I believe, who was ordained into the priesthood by Joseph Smith, you know, these kinds of things you won't find apparently being done by funds that are controlled by the church office building.
So another topic that's covered in your book is the church's involvement in non-church related financial ventures. And this is a bit of a hot topic today with the church's current involvement in the more than $1 billion City Creek Mall project. across the street from Temple Square. But before talking about the church's present-day involvement in non-church-related financial ventures, I think it makes sense to provide some historical perspective, because church involvement in financial ventures goes all the way back to Joseph Smith and Brigham Young, does it not?
It would seem that way, yeah. I mean, you've got Revelations in there to start a hotel, to sort of donate your money here and there. So it's not as if this is a new thing where the church, the Mormon church is being involved in, commercial activities.
Is there any difference between the needs that were supposed to be addressed through the financial ventures of Joseph Smith and Brigham Young, say, and the needs of the City Creek Mall project?
Probably. if you've got Brigham Young coming out into what is really a desert, and he's going to use church funds to build a mill, that doesn't seem like it's got a direct relationship to church. However, to sort of put that into contrast here, what is going on and has been going on for some time is a sort of downtown revitalization of Salt Lake City that is being funded not exclusively by the presiding bishop, but the actual finances of this aren't public. So it's hard to see just how much or how deeply they're involved here. We had an initial announcement that the presiding bishop would be spending $1 billion to build a new mall in place of the ZCMI Center and Crossroads Mall. And they would be knocking down several city blocks in Salt Lake City to build a new kind of high-end retail establishment that would be a rival to the Gateway Center, which was built in anticipation of the 2002 Winter Olympics, which is...
And this is right across the street from the temple, is that right?
That's right. The City Creek is right across the street. And the concern here was that if the downtown property around Temple Square deteriorated, that would affect the impression or the actual value of church properties on Temple Square and thereabouts. And so as a way of sort of ensuring that the downtown Salt Lake City didn't turn into Detroit, the presiding bishop and other members in the community, in the business community of Salt Lake City, put together this massive revitalization plan that is called Downtown Rising, I believe. So it's called the City Creek Center is the mall, which is named after the creek, of course, that that'll be built upon. The City Creek Mall was initially going to be $1 billion. It's now apparently over $3 billion is going to be put into this mall, and it is actually creating a bit of a stir in the area among faithful Latter-day Saints. They have opposed opinions on this thing, whether the church ought to be involved in this kind of an operation. Many people will say yes. It's great that we have the church here to sort of prop up a faltering economy and to make sure that Salt Lake City doesn't go into real decline. It's difficult to sort of counter something like that. I mean, of course, isn't it important that we employ people, that we have a nice looking city, that it's modern and efficient and providing a nice walkway for people in the winter. It would seem that way. Again, this is going to sound like I've got a list of grudges or gripes against malls and Avalons and so on. But there is another side of this that the Mormons are also concerned about, whether the church ought to be throwing billions of dollars into the creation of a mall. You know, whether this is going to help the economy or not is, again, a matter of sort of future speculation. You can't really argue against the claim that if we weren't to do this, what might happen in downtown Salt Lake City? Well, that's not really an argument that you can put forward or counter. We don't know what's going to happen if we didn't build this mall. We don't know that the economy would or would not crash if we were going to build this mall. So the argument for like future stability doesn't seem to hold a lot of water with me and with a lot of other people. Now the argument about whether it's right for a religion that has done a great deal of PR work lately to promote its humanitarian side, and apparently they do some humanitarian work. Though there's a bit of an irony, you know, I hear in Elders Quorum, for example, that the church does a lot of humanitarian activities, but they don't really promote it so that people know about it. You know, and the question, of course, is, well, how did you know about it? Well, they saw it on TV. So there is a lot of public relations work that is being done to kind of counter the impression that the church is just a business and it's just involved in real estate. And, you know, sometimes...
And I think they're quick to point out that this is not tithing funds.
That's right, yes.
It's not $3 billion of tithing.
That's right. Yeah, we were assured that no tithing dollars were used in this. And not to sort of put doubt into it without any kind of evidence, but there is no accounting that anybody outside the church office building has seen. And my understanding of the accounting is that tithing money goes into a general accounting fund, just as any excess fast offerings that are not spent at the stake level are also directed into these general funds, and that legally... they can do whatever they want with these funds because they are labeled general purpose. So, you know, it's probably true that no tithing dollars from Sister Gonzalez in Mexico City are being used to build this mall. But where did the money come from? Well, maybe it came from the for-profit endeavors. Maybe it came from good investments. If that's the case, you know, and perfectly possible that it is.
Where did the capital come from to start those for-profit businesses?
That's right. It's not as if they were selling shoes and then got into the religion business. The funds of these things are largely, you know, the majority of that $6 billion is tithing money. So if they've got a reserve of several billion dollars that now they can move into these kinds of real estate redevelopment plans, is it the case that we really don't have anywhere else we could spend $3 billion to help people in Utah or in Bolivia or in Europe or in Africa or in Asia? Is it the case that that all the tithing dollars are spent and everybody's needs are actually satisfied, and so we've just got a couple billion dollars sitting around? Why not make a really cool mall that has you know, a lot of virtual reality going on, which was kind of one of the selling points initially, is that it would have cool virtual reality.
And I guess so. The question being, again, you know, employing people and preventing cities from going to urban decay is laudable. Why the preference for Salt Lake City?
Right. And also, you know, you can employ people in many different ways. You don't need to employ them at Saks Fifth Avenue. You can employ them at clinics. You can employ them, you know, in many different ways, you know, as educators in Africa. There's a lot of different ways you can create employment, and I'm not sure that that the Mormon Church should just be focusing on creating employment for construction companies located in the immediate area.
And or the retail sector, you know, the shops that will ultimately be located in the mall.
That's right. And, you know, and these are high-end retail shops. And so at the same time, we're being told to tighten up our budgets and then to make sure we don't skimp on our donations. We're also you know, and being told to live frugally and within our means, we're also being directed to this high-end retail establishment, which is across from the temple, so that as the presiding bishop said, we can do a little shopping or maybe go out to dinner before we make a visit downtown or make a visit to Temple Square. So the way that he framed it was a matter of leveraging the importance of Temple Square into capital.
I read one of these, you know, I received one of these emails that members of the church received from time to time from a well-meaning friend who wanted to pass along a sort of faith-promoting story. And this particular email had Bishop Burton, the presiding bishop of the church, giving a speech, sort of giving an apologetic defense of this mall project. And he said basically that this mall project was vitally needed to preserve the sanctity of the temple, which is something you can't really argue against. But the idea, I guess, being that you wanted to create this nice buffer zone of
upper middle class retail.
I guess nice looking property, nicely developed property around the temple. Is that something you've? I don't live in Utah. Is that something you've heard up there?
No, not through emails or anything like that. It might just be that it's assumed that they don't really have to explain themselves, and that if you are critical of whatever it is that they're doing, then you know you obviously don't have your faith in the right areas. So you know the argument that it's needed to preserve the sanctity of the temple. You know, I don't have any way of sort of making an argument against that any more than you could say, well, you know, how would you prove something like the sanctity of the temple is somehow diminished because there's, you know, sort of cheap clothing stores across the street. Like, I don't honestly see the connection, you know, between the level of retail that surrounds Temple Square and the sort of spirituality that occurs inside the temples.
Mm-hmm. It just sort of strikes me that perhaps the reason why we have a bit of schizophrenia within the church about these issues of money is that, I mean, to be honest, the scriptures aren't really clear. The scriptures are, at least to me, they seem contradictory on the question of the relationship between righteousness and material prosperity. On the one hand, you've got Abraham being a very prosperous patriarch who's sort of rewarded for his spirituality through, you know, abundant herds of camels and whatnot. You've got repeated over and over again in the Book of Mormon the promise that if you are righteous, you will prosper in the land. So the sort of endorsement of the puritanical work ethic and material prosperity being a reward or an outward evidence of your inner spiritual righteousness. And yet on the other hand, you have Jesus being unemployed, homeless, and calling, you know, blue collar, working class people to be his leaders, and telling them to travel without purse or scrip, and telling them, you know, basically don't worry about money. So is this schizophrenia we have in the church a function of perhaps the schizophrenia within scripture?
This issue. It is, and I think, you know, the schizophrenia you see in scripture is just part of the schizophrenia you see in the entire world, right? Where this is something that every dispensation, I think, has to wrestle with is how do they create these kinds of lines? You know, you see it in the Book of Mormon. And this is one of the things I remember from seminary is this cycle of prosperity, where because the members are righteous, they work hard, you know, they're honest, they become prosperous, and then, you know, they become prideful, and then they fall. And it is one of those things that clearly, just because you're rich doesn't mean you're a wicked person. I don't want to be sort of read as sort of indicating anything like that. You know, my sense is that it doesn't matter one way or the other, because those are just numbers, you know, that we're assigning to people. And anytime you assign a number as trying to read righteousness, I sort of have doubts as to how accurate something like that could be. So, yeah, it really is a difficult problem, because, as you point out, there are a lot of guys who are pretty wealthy, and that doesn't seem to make them enemies to God. So, you know, Brigham Young was quoted as saying, apparently, that if we all lived the law of consecration, we would all be pretty wealthy. You know, but what seems to be going alongside wealth is, and this I think applies to the corporations as well as to individuals, the different kinds of obligations and temptations and interactions seem to follow the acquisition of great deals of capital. And this is what I sort of want to point out through this kind of metaphor of talking about the spirit of mammon, or the development of something like mammon as a figurative entity that makes decisions for us. And it doesn't make decisions, of course, as an actual person. It makes decisions through these very small and seemingly insignificant day-to-day decisions that we all make. And, you know, in terms of, you know, this schizophrenia where we have to serve God and mammon, Jesus seems to put a pretty hard line on it. You know, whether Abraham served mammon first and then got rich, or whether he served God and then got wealthy because he could be trusted, whereas somebody like Solomon seemed to be in pretty good terms with God until he built, you know, a house out of gold that was bigger than God's house. You know, that seemed to create some kinds of animosity between the Lord and Solomon. You know, it's one of those things that, again, we don't have clear instructions on, and I think that there's reasons why we don't have clear instructions on that, whereas we have clear instructions on how many piercings we're supposed to have. And the reason why I think we don't have clear instructions is because mammon doesn't allow clear instructions like that.
Well, let's hope that the square footage of the City Creek Mall is smaller than the square footage of the Salt Lake Temple.
Doesn't look that way.
Okay. So your book concludes with a summary of your argument that you see us treading on dangerously thin ice, in that we might be inadvertently, you know, with all the good intentions of the world, converting our religion into what you call capitalism in some strange disguise. Can you just sort of summarize your overall argument or the point of your book for us, just in conclusion?
Yeah, there's a couple sort of misinterpretations I want to get out there first and say I'm not saying that the church is in apostasy. I'm not saying that that capitalism is a bad thing, and necessarily just another word for mammon. What I am saying is that what we call religion is increasingly thought of and treated as a commodity, which is marketed in ways that modern corporations market anything. And so what we are increasingly, I think, experiencing as Mormons is something that is in the image of religion, but is not necessarily the same thing as religion. And this isn't a kind of conspiracy among the general authorities. Honestly, I make the argument that the general authorities don't have a whole lot of influence, actually, in what goes on in the church office building. And I think the higher up you go in the ecclesiastical hierarchy, the less influence they actually have as individuals to shape what goes on at the church office building, or certainly outside the church office building and all the other corporate entities. So my argument is something like, what mammon promised to provide in John Milton's Paradise Lost was not a challenge to heaven. What he offered when each of the devils is kind of I guess it's a kind of focus group in hell after they'd been banished from heaven. Each of them takes up, you know, is allowed to stand up and say what the fallen angels ought to be doing. And Mammon stands up and he says, well, we can create the image of heaven. And as long as people don't actually go and experience heaven, they won't know any different. And so we can make darkness into light and light into darkness. And there's a reason why I titled the Book of Mammon, is because this is what I see going on, is the creation of a new kind of imaginary, as we call it in anthropology, which is to say we are involved in the construction of the image of heaven as we see it, which is not to say we're constructing Zion. We're constructing Zion as a kind of trademark or as a sort of retail establishment, which is, you know, I laugh, but I laugh not because I'm sort of mocking this or I'm trying to simplify it. It's a very, very difficult argument that I'm trying to make, and it's not that the church is in apostasy. The argument is that the church doesn't exist as it used to exist. It exists as something which is something like the image of a church. So I don't know if that summary makes it clear. And this is why I'm saying it's capitalism in a strange disguise. It's not as if you've got just rampant 19th century capitalism draping itself in the robes of the priesthood. What you have is sort of postmodern capitalism that is very adept at public relations, which is another way of saying it's very adept at creating a kind of imaginary in which consumers can now take on different identities, and that for every identity they take on, there is the creation of value that then accrues in the form of capital among the producers of those identities and those kinds of lifestyles. So religion here is being constructed. It's not just a Mormon thing. It's something that you see going on in anything that you want to call religion nowadays. It's a matter of lifestyle in the same ways that, you know, whether you want to call yourself you know, a member of the goth community or the gay community or the, you know, the intellectual community, you can call yourself a member of the Mormon community. And we've provided all the material that you need to sort of to make that believable.
Okay. So I'd like to just give you an opportunity to end the way John usually likes to end all of his interviews, which is to give you an opportunity to share your testimony with us. And before I do that, of course, because I'm going to let you have the final word, just really want to thank you for coming on to Mormon Stories and explaining to us your dissertation on the history of correlation and your discussion of the influence of corporate culture on the church in the Book of Mammon. And so thanks a lot for coming on to Mormon Stories, and I'll let you conclude with your testimony.
Yeah, first of all, thank you. It's been a pleasure. I want to thank any of the remaining audience who is still with us, besides the two of us. really, it's been a pleasure, and I hope that I've said things that you know, that maybe will make some sense to people. And really, you know, the point of my work is to try to help people make sense of where they might be in the sort of modern culture of Mormonism. You know, I wrote the dissertation to help myself make sense of my relationship to Mormonism, which was in some ways temporally displaced. And this sort of goes at the heart of what I think you might call a testimony, which is that I don't really have any doubts that what Joseph Smith revealed really is the true gospel, and it has the potential to do what he said, which is revolutionize the entire world. To grind down all forms of oppression and wickedness, and to create the kind of community where the gods could walk among us and not be embarrassed, or and we wouldn't be ashamed to be in their presence. I really do believe that you know, that Joseph Smith revealed these kinds of truths. But, you know, as part of my testimony as well, I really believe that we as Mormons, and I don't exclude myself from this, that we have gone far astray from what Joseph Smith tried to reveal, and that were he to walk among us, and I, as part of my testimony, actually believe that, in fact, Joseph Smith is among us, walking and looking and seeing what we are doing with what he's revealed, that he is probably not pleased with the way things have turned out. The main principles that he's revealed we have abandoned, and we have replaced a great deal of what he hoped to do with things that are that make sense to a world that Joseph Smith did not create, but that he tried to shape. So, you know, my testimony here is it's a sort of bittersweet thing. I do believe these things, you know, about the gospel as we understand it, about Joseph Smith's teachings about Jesus. With Joseph Smith's teachings about our relationships to each other, and also our relationships to things like the law of justice and things of mercy. These things are true. I don't really have any doubts about them. I've made, you know, my adulthood, most of my adult life, in pretty serious study and contemplation and research, at what I think is a pretty high level, of scholarship. And this is something that I realized when I was at Penn, is the more I spent, the more time that I spent and the more attention I devoted to the study of Mormonism, the more it began to unfold a certain kind of beauty that simply wasn't there anywhere else. It's not there in academia. It's not there in other systems of knowledge. That Mormonism really does have it. The question then is, what kind of Mormonism really has it? And my personal experience of growing up in a post-correlated Mormonism, and still, of course, a member of a post-correlated Mormonism, makes it clear to me that we don't have the same kinds of things that they had in the early church. We don't have the same kinds of charismatic experiences. We don't have the same kind of relationship to heaven that they had. And, you know, the point for me, and honestly the point of a lot of my research, is to help us understand how things have changed. And they've changed in radically and very, very complicated ways. It's not so simple as there was a bad guy who came along and started to preach something different. It's not the case that that the members all became evil and abandoned the gospel. The kinds of changes that I try to document are changes that occur through language, and changes that occur in widely distributed forms of organization in the modern world. You know, these are things that I've been trained to see, and in some ways I feel obliged to then try to describe for other people in a way that makes sense to them. You know, I could have written the Book of Mammon in a very academic way, and I could have, you know, tried to get an academic publisher for it, and I don't think I would have had much difficulty doing either one. I decided to self-publish it. And I decided to write it how I thought it needed to be written, so that it could reach Mormons who were interested in these kinds of questions. People who, in some sense, still believed in the gospel in the ways that I try to believe it, but also in some ways want to understand maybe their relationship and maybe some sense of, you know, dissatisfaction. So, you know, that's may not be the same kind of testimony that you might hear on Sunday, you know, but it's a sincere testimony, nevertheless.
Well, Damon Smith, thank you once again for joining us here on Mormon Stories.
Thanks again. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. To comment on this episode or to provide feedback, please check us out at mormonstories.org. If you want to help keep Mormon Stories alive, please consider either making a financial contribution or spreading the word about this episode through your blog, Twitter account, Facebook page, family newsletter, or through your ward bulletin and ward newsletter. Just kidding about those last two. Music on this episode was provided by Clayton and Sky Pixton. Check them out at claytonpixton.com or skypixton.com. That's Sky with an E, S-K-Y-E, pixton.com. Thank you.